You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Charlie Zimmerman. The Democratic Party is the oldest still existing political party in the world and has existed almost as long as the United States. Yet it has not existed unchanged, and nor will it continue to exist unchanged. The last few years have brought massive upheaval to the party, with some of the most prominent figures, such as Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi, nearing the end of their long careers while a new generation of party leadership begins theirs. Today, we look at the truce, progressive centrist, and the future of the Democratic Party. It discusses the challenges currently facing the party and the possible ways it will move forward. The book is co-authored by former White House correspondent and investigative journalist Hunter Walker, who was unfortunately unable to be with us today. I'm here with his co-author, Lupe Lupin, who is a lawyer, reporter, and commentator whose publications have been featured in outlets such as The Washington Post and Vanity Fair. Lupe, welcome.
Thank you, Charlotte. Thanks for having me on.
So let's start with 2008. What was so significant about this year for the Democratic Party?
Starting in 2008, you see obviously the really drawn out long battle between Barack Obama, who's running at the time as a young challenger to the Democratic establishment, and a fairly progressive candidate, someone who was opposed to the Iraq War, and he was facing off against Hillary Clinton, who was a established, Democrat and the wife of a former president and a senator from New York, someone who had deep ties within the party. And in 2008, which is a little bit before the timeline that we spend most of our time on, the truce, you do see the party starting to split into these two factions between progressive, sort of insurgent, outsider candidates, don't have a lot of deep ties to the establishment, and on the other side, centrists. And what's interesting about 2008, obviously, is progressives win. Barack Obama ultimately defeats Hillary Clinton. He takes over a part of the Democratic Party as he's running for president and serves for 8 years. And Barack Obama in that period sort of becomes more of an establishment figure. And you see the cycle sort of repeat after 8 years of Obama in 2016 when Hillary Clinton's running again, this time as Obama's former Secretary of State. And she's facing off against Bernie Sanders, who runs as an even further left candidate than Obama had, and really attracts a surprising, at the time at least to us, we thought it was a surprising amount of energy and enthusiasm from young progressives who were sort of dissatisfied with how the mainstream Democratic Party, even as represented by the Obama administration, had been pursuing policies and who didn't want to see Hillary Clinton as the nominee, and that was another long and drawn-out primary where you see these two factions pitted against each other. And the story we tell in the truce is that long and bruising primary is almost as important as the character of Donald Trump as a candidate in explaining how 2016 went and why you see a lot of Democrats not coming to the polls in the general election in 2016. And if you fast forward to 2020, the story of how Donald Trump is defeated and how Joe Biden becomes the president, we think, is a really important case of the party reaching out to progressives and trying to bind together these two factions that had been at odds for so long in order to create a winning coalition.
And what about these progressive caucuses in the Democratic Party? And with the progressive caucuses are, of course, the more conservative caucuses. So what are those caucuses look like, and how was that affected by this sort of rift in the party begun by these elections?
Absolutely. Most importantly, presidential campaigns, they're seeking the White House and they're important tests of leadership, but they're also breeding grounds for new activism, for new organizing and new types of candidates. And in the Bernie Sanders campaign, you see a lot of organizers and some candidates emerge from the ranks of volunteers and staffers on that campaign. We track several of them in our book. And some of those former Bernie Sanders volunteers and staffers come to Congress either as elected members, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is a volunteer for Sanders, and some as staffers, including a lot of AOC's staff, who were also Sanders veterans. There's a large progressive caucus in Congress. It's been around for a long time. It's called the CPC, the Congressional Progressive Caucus. It's led by Pramila Jayapal. And they're, I think, the largest group of Democrats in the House, so it really does cover a broad swath of ideological flavors, if you will, on the left side of the party. But the Progressive Caucus is a major caucus, and they tend to be more to the left, more progressive than the New Democrats and the Blue Dogs. Blue Dogs are sort of the most conservative members of the Democratic Party and the other ones you often see aligning with Republicans on a bill that has some cross-aisle movement. And so those are those to me are sort of the major parts of the Democratic Party on the Hill: the Progressive Caucus to the left, the New Democrats in the center, Blue Dogs to the right. And then you have sort of smaller groups that break off from there.
And did these factions really exist before 2008 and 2016?
There's certainly a long tradition in the Democratic Party of activism from both centrist and progressive activism that does go back many decades. What's different is that progressives have been gradually more and more successful. I don't think there was any candidate prior to Bernie Sanders who ran a real, viable challenge for the Democratic nomination and took positions as far left as Bernie Sanders did and identified as a socialist candidate. There are previous socialist candidates that we could talk about earlier in the 20th century, so they certainly exist, but they never really gathered the kind of momentum and posed the kind of threat to the Democratic establishment that Sanders did. And so I think what's significant about this this politics that we see now is that Democrats are having to adjust the mean of the party, the center of the party, to the left to try to appeal to the significant faction of voters that's out there that wants more progressive candidates and more progressive solutions, policy solutions implemented.
And while we're talking about these shifts in the Democratic Party, let's talk about the 2020 election, because, of course, this primary differed pretty significantly from 2008 and 2016. What was so different about the 2020 election from those other two?
The first thing that hits you when you look at the 2020 election is how many people were looking to run. Because you had an incumbent Republican president and no clear successor sort of left over, there was, of course, Joe Biden, who had been Barack Obama's vice president, who was clear he was going to run, but no, I don't think he was clearing the field in any way. And Hillary Clinton wasn't going to run again, and we figured that out fairly early on in 2020. And so you see a lot of contenders who are hoping to be the next standard bearer for the Democratic Party in this vast debate stage early on in the primary, where they have to do it on two nights. And there's a real wide variety in 2020 of potential candidates. And there's also, in 2020, this memory of 2016. We take the view that in our book, that the rift in the Democratic Party in that long 2016 primary sort of smoldered on into the general election and hurt Democrats in terms of turnout from younger and more progressive voters. And if you look at the key states, you can see that lack of getting people in the polls is decisive. And that's a view that's shared by, for one, Barack Obama and a lot of members of Joe Biden's team who we talked to. And so they were very interested in finding a way not to have such a bruising and divisive primary in 2020. We found in The Truce, we report the story, I think for the first time, that Barack Obama intervened behind the scenes. He was giving speeches as early as 2019 to members of Congress, trying to get them to think about progressives and think about how to bring progressives into the party and unify the party going forward. And during the 2020 primary campaign, Obama was making calls to some of the more centrist candidates saying, hey, look, we are, give it your best shot. Do as much as you can in this primary, but you're going to hear from me again. And if you're not in the lead, I'm going to be asking you to stand behind someone so that we can get as much momentum as possible behind our candidate when it comes time to sort of close ranks and consolidate. And so you see the sort of more centrist candidates doing that for Joe Biden right after he wins in South Carolina in 2020. And it has a big impact on the race. Biden took a lot of momentum into Super Tuesday, and Sanders was having a hard time. And that, in part, is the story of the 2020 primary.
You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange. I'm Charlie Zimmerman. Our guest is journalist Lupe Lupin, speaking with us about the book, The Truce, Progressive, Centrist, and the Future of the Democratic Party. So more on the 2020 election, you talk about a pretty significant technical issue with the Iowa caucus that essentially ended up costing Bernie the momentum that could have carried him to a victory. Can you talk about that?
In 2020, the Iowa Democratic Party is running the Iowa caucuses, which is a sort of old system, and we get into the history of how caucuses work and how sort of more complicated they are than primaries, because everybody's got to get in a room and sort of sort themselves into groups and then figure out who's got a viable candidate and who doesn't, redivide, and do counts. So it's a complicated system. Once everyone's been in the room, there's even more complicated math to translate those results into what they call state delegate equivalents in Iowa. And the state party does its best every year to try to do all that math and announce a result in the caucus. And in 2020, Iowa's systems broke down. They weren't able to communicate results back to the party headquarters because the party had this technical issue. And so there were no answers on the night of the Iowa caucus, which left a lot of the campaigns flat-footed. And campaigns planned for victory. They also planned for defeat in these contests. No one had planned for the Iowa to just sort of be a blank. That created for the campaigns the question of what do you do? How do you try to generate momentum heading into New Hampshire? And for the Sanders campaign, it was a real drama. In their war room, they had a lot of people saying, hey, you got to get up and declare victory. Just say we won, move on. Bernie Sanders and several of his staffers don't feel like that's the right way to approach politics. They didn't, because of a sort of ironic technical failure within their own campaign, they weren't getting data from the caucus either. They had an internal app that was supposed to collect data from the volunteers about how things were going, and it didn't work. And they tried to sort of hack something together with their Google spreadsheet kind of application, and they got some data, but they didn't get enough to feel confident in the numbers. And so they didn't want to go out and make that announcement. And you saw on the other side of the other candidate who was contesting Iowa and may have placed close to first was Pete Buttigieg. And he had some more confidence in the numbers he was seeing. And he came out and he declared that he was emerging victorious, a very carefully chosen phrase, as it turned out, heading into New Hampshire. And a lot of the Sanders people felt very wounded by that disparity, seeing him get up on TV and sort of claim the victory when they weren't able to. And that moment in Iowa sort of creates a stumbling block for the Sanders campaign that they never truly recovered from. I mean, they came back and did well in New Hampshire, but they didn't have the momentum they were hoping for, the fundraising they were hoping for after Iowa, and it set the stage for Biden's eventual resurgence, because the other thing that's going on in Iowa is Joe Biden wasn't anywhere close to first. We think he was fifth in the ultimate results. No one actually reported the results of the Iowa caucus. The AP said they couldn't call the race. We went back and found that after everyone had dropped out and after it didn't matter anymore and some negotiations, the Sanders campaign actually had the most delegates under their control going into the Democratic convention. So technically, Bernie Sanders did win the Iowa caucus. But the Sanders campaign came out of the Iowa caucus wounded because of these cascading technical issues. The difficulty in getting messaging out that night, the difficulty in translating that into fundraising, the momentum of voters. And Iowa is now doing things essentially as a primary. They're voting by mail, so they really don't have the same sort of position in Democratic politics as a result of the reforms the Democratic Party made in the aftermath of those technical problems they experienced in 2020. I think the reforms in the Democratic Party are really interesting because not only did they change the order, getting rid of Iowa first and moving things around on the calendar, they also committed to changing the order every 4 years. So every 4 years, the Democrats are saying they're going to do a new calendar, look at which states are first, potentially make changes. And so I think the campaigns are going to start even earlier, which is amazing because American presidential campaigns are some of the longest in the world. But I think we're going to start to see that really important things are happening even before votes are cast in the Democratic primary, where you have these party meetings that are deciding who's going to go first in the primary, who's going to be recognized and who's not going to be. And that sort of ordering of the states could have a real impact on who's able to win, who's able to gather the momentum we were talking about earlier. So I expect Democratic politics to become in way more interior, more focused on sort of the pre-voting struggles, and also very interesting in the years to come, especially in 2028.
We've been speaking with political journalist Lupe Lupin about his book, The Truce, Progressive, Centrist, and the Future of the Democratic Party. Lupe, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
I'm Charlie Zimmerman, and this is the Jefferson Exchange.
That's it for today's JX segments. JeffExchange.org is our website where you can find these conversations and more. I'm Mike Green. Angela Decker is our senior producer, and Andrew Crackle is engineering our show today. Thanks for joining us, and have a nice day.